Well, good evening. I'm Lauren Branch, and I'm chairman of the Oklahoma Alliance for Public Transportation, and I want to thank each of you for being here this evening to learn about an issue that is vital to the future of Oklahoma City. The Oklahoma Alliance for Public Transportation, or APT, is a statewide coalition whose focus is to increase awareness of transit issues and advocate for adequate funding of public transportation in Oklahoma. APT recognizes that a solid transportation infrastructure is vital to further economic development efforts in Oklahoma City and throughout the state. Public transportation enhances our quality of life, benefits the environment, and ensures that everyone, regardless of ability or financial means, can be a full participant in our communities. In my day job, I am the president and CEO of Newview Oklahoma, the state's largest employer of blind and visually impaired individuals. Public transportation is a huge issue for our employees, but sadly, very few of them are able to be here tonight because the buses stop running before this program is over. That sort of access to public transportation is the very thing APT is working to improve. There's a lot of interest in transit in Oklahoma City right now. That much is obvious from the incredible attendance here tonight. But it is crucial that city leaders and the public understand the trade-offs and considerations that go into building a transit system. That's why we're thrilled to have Jarrett Walker with us tonight. I know that we will all learn something from his talk and come away with a greater awareness of the myriad of decisions that we need to make. Because it's important to get this right for public transit to be successful in Oklahoma City, we have to develop and implement the right plan for our city. We also have some representatives from Nelson Nygaard Consulting Company here tonight. The Central Oklahoma Transportation and Parking Authority recently entered into a contract with Nelson Nygaard to review, evaluate, and make recommendations to improve the operating efficiency of the current public transportation system given our current funding. The study is currently underway and will seek public input later this spring with results expected in early May. Those consultants are available here tonight with a booth in the back if you would like to speak to them one-on-one after the program. I would like to thank Councilman Ed Shadid for helping organize this event and bring Jarrett Walker to speak with us tonight. And additional thanks goes to the Farmers Public Market who donated the space to us this evening. If you would like more information, we're also located online at okapt.org, on Facebook, and on Twitter. Our next speaker, Doug Rex, serves as the director for the Association of Central Oklahoma Governments, ACOG, Transportation and Planning Services Division. As division director, Mr. Rex is responsible for the leadership, coordination, development, and administration of transportation and community development issues that impact the Central Oklahoma region. Mr. Rex, who joined ACOG in 1996, holds a master's degree in urban planning from the University of Kansas. He was previously employed by the City of Topeka and the Mid-America Regional Council, MARC, the Council of Governments servicing the Kansas City metropolitan area. He also served as an adjunct professor of transportation planning at the University of Oklahoma's Regional and City Planning Division. And after Mr. Rex comes up and speaks, Councilman Ed Shadid will be up and offer some remarks. So please join me in welcoming Doug Rex.
But what I would like to do in the next 20 minutes or so is just to provide a kind of a regional perspective on public transportation. And really even talk to some of the accomplishments that we've already made thus far. So I'm going to hurry through this rather quickly, a lot of information. Well, first I have to give the one obligatory slide about ACOG and who we are. We're a voluntary association of local governments serving the Central Oklahoma area. It's a regional forum that provides an opportunity for our local governments to get together and discuss like issues that span larger than just one entity. And that is really the true genius of what ACOG does. It's really one of the only time that our member local governments get together and discuss items because they all have their own issues. And this really does provide that forum for discussion and debate. And we're extremely proud of that. Some of the programs that we administer at ACOG is we administer the 911 system outside of Oklahoma City proper. We obviously have a water division as well, because water is the new gold, of course. And transportation, which, of course, I'm going to talk about here today, and some other ancillary programs such as air quality planning, economic development initiatives, and the like. So why regional public transportation? And we all know we love our cars and trucks here in central Oklahoma. And we are certainly blessed to have a street and highway infrastructure that is second to none in this country. It provides an opportunity for allow people to with options on where they want to live. I mean, they can live out as far as they want from activity centers. But it is also a curse in the simple fact that the ability to have little or low congestion has really forced some development patterns which are just not sustainable. And we understand that based on our projections that, you know, this is going to catch up to us sooner or later. Certainly we're showing significant levels of congestion on our interstate and highway facilities in the, in the 2030, 2035 range. So as we continue to grow, we know we're going to have to begin to explore other options with regards to how we get people to and fro. So the question really then becomes, you know, how do you begin to plan for this future? Well, and that's why we're looking at regional public transportation options. You know, economic development is a huge angle with regards to regional public transportation, the ability to attract workers and the like, and I'll talk about that more here in a second. The other thing I highlighted here is the graying of America. There's over 35 million people in this country currently are over the age of 65. That number is expected to double by the year 2030. You know, I think it's important to gain that perspective. I mean, we're going to have a lot, including myself and everybody in this room, that, you know, maybe not shouldn't be behind the wheel all the time, or maybe that person doesn't want to be behind the wheel all the time. So we have to begin to look for options that makes it effective and efficient transportation for the elderly. Well, just some general, you know, information about where we currently are, and this is not the... It's not the best number in the world, I mean, but I think everybody here can certainly understand and agree with this. I mean, based on a ranking of the 50 largest metropolitan areas, we were last when looked at cities that were best prepared for $4 gasoline. And I know, you know, gas is starting to creep up here again. Back in 2008 time period when it was creeped pretty close to $4 a gallon, it became a tremendous issue. And we were getting calls about, you know, regional public transportation initiatives. What is it we hope to accomplish as a region, you know, to provide better options for the general public? And this is certainly not an indictment on the agencies that provide that public transportation that we have in central Oklahoma. It speaks to two things. It speaks, one, to how expensive it is to run public transportation, and it also speaks to basically the level or the lack of funding that we currently have for our regional public transportation. Our service agencies, they do what they can, and they provide a tremendous service for the amount of their budgets, and we are appreciative of the work that they do. The other thing I would like to point out with regards to, you know, why now? First of all, planning, you know, like everything else, takes a long time. We've been in this process now for several years, and it's going to take several more years before we can get to the point of implementation if that is the desire of this region to fulfill. You know, we're in competition with for high-skilled workers, particularly those new out of colleges. We want to be able to provide transportation options which we believe is gives us that competitive edge or advantage. Look at what some of what they're saying in Milwaukee and what they're saying in Denver. If you look at that quote there from the Milwaukee Journal, it talks about economic success in the 21st century requires making a region attractive to an educated workforce. Corporations have discovered that a good transit system is essential to recruiting such talent. I mean, this is coming from business leaders in these communities. In Denver, this project will cause many businesses to move to Denver because companies know their employees will not have to sit in traffic. Their employees will be home for dinner and home life. Well, so then in 2009, we initiated a regional dialogue to begin this discussion about a regional public transportation system. And it really, I mean, it might not sound like a big deal, but quite frankly, this was the first time elected leaders from our communities as well as business leaders got together and began to ask themselves these important questions in establishing a regional transportation system. Such questions like, well, first of all, do we want to pursue this? Is this something we're interested in doing? And assuming the answer is yes, how do you fund this type of system? You assume you're creating a regional authority to govern this. Well, how do you govern it? What does that governing structure look like? Are the commissioners elected? Are they appointed? What can cities do to prepare themselves for this expansion of public transportation in the land use development area? These are questions that have really never been asked before. And so we started this initiative back in 2009, as I mentioned, and with a steering committee of about 22, 24 members, equally divided between public elected officials and private business leaders throughout the entire region. It was chaired by Mayor Mick Cornett, and I believe, you know, we really did end up getting some very good answers or preliminary answers to those questions that I just asked. I'm not going to go through those tonight. I would encourage you, if you haven't already done so, to visit our website for the recommendations and final reports from that. I think you'll be surprised by the level of detail that we've gone into thus far. So that takes us to the Regional Transit Dialogue 2, or RTD2. As we like to call it, at the COG. We are taking a second look at this. We're going to refocus our efforts and start this whole phase over again. We actually started it back in November of 2012, and so we don't have a whole lot to report on that right now, but we're encouraged by some of the results. And I know, you know, to the average person out there, it seems, I know you guys get frustrated by the amount of talk that we do. There's not a whole lot of action. But, I mean, a lot of this stuff takes a lot of time to work out the details, as you can imagine. And we have accomplished quite a bit. And I would like to quickly just run through some of those accomplishments that we have to date. And they really are the foundation for this RTD2 that we're pursuing now. And I'm just going to hit on these individually. The 2005 Fixed Guideway Study, I think most of you are probably... Many of you are familiar with this whole effort. And this really has become our map or guidebook, dare I say our Bible, for public transportation in central Oklahoma. And what the study did, it was done by Metro Transit. And what the study did, it was provide, they looked at corridors throughout the entire region and tried to match various public transportation technologies that would best serve those corridors. So as a result, you know, we looked at a variety of technologies such as, well, commuter rail, streetcar, bus rapid transit, and I'll speak to those in more detail now in a second. Now, those are the sexy modes. Everybody loves, you know, trains and all that kind of stuff. But I can tell you now that a regional public transportation system cannot operate efficiently without a more robust, enhanced bus system. It is truly the backbone of any regional public transportation system. And I think everybody needs to know that going in, that there's going to have to be a tremendous upgrade in our bus service in this region for two reasons, to serve individual routes on its own, but also to serve as a feeder system for the fixed guideway, the rail-based transportation options to get you to your final destination. So it is extremely important that we don't forget how important bus transportation is. All right, as far as the sexy stuff, some of the fixed guideway technologies that were explored were vast and many. We even looked at monorail. It was thrown out pretty quickly due to the cost of it. And as much as we like to look like Disney World, we're probably not going to look like it. Bus rapid transit is not your grandfather's bus. This is really, you know, people like to refer to it as rubber tire light rail. It operates very similar to light rail. It's just not on an embedded rail. It pulls up to the station. It can operate, you know, in the lanes of traffic, which is very typical, or it could operate in its own separate right-of-way. And this was actually an example. It's a simulation of it operating in its own separate right-of-way. It has signal preemption. It pulls up flush to the platforms like light rail, for those who are familiar with it. It's quite good, and is at a fraction of the cost of light rail. commuter rail. Now, this is something I'm going to talk about a little more here in a second, but this commuter rail is one of those technologies that is, it's, you know, is something that can be implemented rather quickly. And it operates, you know, on the existing freight network. It's compatible with the freight rail that we currently have out there, the BNSF and the UP lines, the Class 1 rail lines. It would operate on those facilities. We would share that in some lease agreement with the Class 1s. And it, you know, it really does ultimately is used primarily for commuter work trips. So peak hour travel is it's higher frequencies in the mornings and the evenings. It also could be used for events such as Thunder games, Thunder Up, and OU football games, of course. And I'm not going to say Boomer Sooner. Boomer Sooner. Modern streetcar is another technology, of course, that was explored. Unless you've been hiding under a rock, you know a lot about this already with regards to you know, what's been implemented as far as MAPS 3. And just to refresh those, refresh your memory, in 2009, the voters of Oklahoma City voted for the passing, the continuance of the MAPS sales tax and funded 8 projects, of which one of which was the downtown streetcar. $120 million in total, and when the project is completed towards the end of this decade, between 5 and 6 miles of streetcar will be in place in the downtown area. Yay. Indeed. Another study that we've undertaken and recently completed is the Intermodal Transportation Hub Study. We started this in 2010, and we really undertook the study to investigate locations and conceptual layout for an intermodal transportation hub. And, you know, it's our Grand Central Station is what it would be. And really what an intermodal hub does, it really integrates all the various technologies and modes that you can think of. So you got commuter rail would interact there, bus rapid transit, streetcar, bicycle, pedestrian, those would all be integrated into one location. Where am I? So, and this was a recommendation of the 2005 that we do this study and come up with a location. So we conducted this study. We looked at 10 sites originally. And we, you know, after months of discussion and analysis, we finally ended up at one location. That was Santa Fe Station. Between Reno and Sheridan on E.K. Gaylord, and I know many of you are familiar with that. And, you know, we're very lucky to be able to have, in a built environment such as downtown, to have a quaint location like this. I think from the outset we always felt that this was a great location if it could handle the future demand for this facility. Could it handle all the train sets and proposed or forecasted commuter line sometime in the future. And after an operational analysis, it was more than capable of doing that. There's 2 platforms that currently exist on the existing structure, and there's room for a third in the event that we need that sometime in the future. So we felt very comfortable with the selection of this location. And I say it's quaint because where else can you build, in a built environment, a facility that is directly smack dab in the middle of the Central Business District and the entertainment district. I mean, that is just unheard of. So we're very fortunate to have this facility, and we think it's going to be a jewel for this region. The city of Oklahoma City is currently in the process of negotiating with the current owners the purchase of this facility. And these are just some artistic renderings of what that might look like. In to the far right, you can see the old historic structure of Santa Fe Station. And in the foreground here, you can see this would be a new structure. That's a parking lot right now. And that would really serve service commuter rail as well as high-speed rail in the event we ever had that in the future. And you can see, you know, some, you know, pretty pictures of what the awnings would look like and all that kind of good stuff up on the platform. Now, the other study that we're very very excited about that we just undertaken, just started, is a commuter corridor study. And what we hope to propose, what we hope to do in this study is we're exploring 3 corridors as identified in the 2005 fixed guideway study That's the blue lines that you see on this. The line from Edmond to downtown Oklahoma City, Norman to downtown Oklahoma City, Midwest City, Tinker Air Force Base to downtown Oklahoma City. And, you know, we're really looking to explore long-term options to help relieve traffic in those high-volume corridors in the future. And one of those options that we will be exploring will be commuter rail. It just lines up so well with the existing freight lines. Those of you who are familiar with this area know that, I'll try this again, that the BNSF tracks run north-south right through the middle of our spine here in Oklahoma City, and then this is a UP line, for the most part, out to Midwest City and beyond. So we're very excited about that, and this is an 18-month study, so we won't be getting the results anytime soon, but we would encourage you that if you're interested in this, there will be plenty of public meetings on each of these corridors. Well, that's it for me. I just want to end by saying that, you know, this really can work in this region. You know, I'll use a phrase that a wise sage, Roy Williams, has used in the past about, you know, planning for public transportation. It's like, don't plan for the city that you currently are today. Plan for the city that you want to be. And, you know, there's no silver bullet for this, guys. I mean, this is going to take a lot of time and effort from a lot of people. And it's going to start with the people in this room to help educate your neighbors, elected officials, about the importance and necessity for this. We're very excited to help in any aspect of this that we can, and we truly believe that we can ultimately become the major league city that we hope to be. Thank you very much. Appreciate you.
First of all, I want to thank you for coming. I'm very grateful for reasons I'll explain. I think that's by far the most important part of the solution, is public engagement and coming to events like this. I also want to acknowledge those who are watching by internet or listening by radio. I think it's paradoxical and sad, frankly, that everybody, unfortunately, that's arriving tonight will arrive by automobile, and that the roughly 100,000 people in the greater Oklahoma City metro area who don't have access to a car or who can't drive a car due to health reasons. Some of them would have liked to come, but as Lauren pointed out, they couldn't because our transit system doesn't run in the evenings. There's a lot of work to be done. I was reminded on Friday how much, I was talking with the Tulsa City Councilor who was recalling how he talked that week with the Tulsa Mayor about the urgency to need that they to act. That they ranked last in terms of ridership, they ranked last in terms of spending, and the Tulsa mayor said, no, we don't, we're next to last. Oklahoma City's last. It goes to show you that even when you're standing in the back of the line, it feels good to see somebody behind you. The problem for us is that nobody's standing behind us. But that's about to change. Your turnout tonight is evidence of the interest in this topic. Our $130 million investment in MAPS 3 is evidence of our interest, and things are going to change. I think there's a growing sense that we're going to need to address the deficiencies in public transportation if we're to grow as a city and maintain relevance in the 21st century. In addition, to the 100,000 or so people who don't have access to a car or who can't drive, there's large movement in the behavior of younger generations towards driving. If you look at how 24 to 34 year olds are behaving now versus just even 10 years ago, the number of vehicle miles that they're driving is plummeting by some 23%. The number of 19 year olds who don't have driver's license is tripled in the last 20 years. There's major movement in terms away from driving. There's a migration of young adults towards large cities where there's more alternatives to driving. The largest influx of 24 to 34 year olds is in Denver, and then that's driving a lot of that. There's a migration of people towards cities where they have a choice. It's not necessarily car or transit. It may be the choice to use both. And you're not going to be able to do that all in the downtown area. You're going to have corridors where people could use transit outside, because the overwhelming majority of us don't live downtown. I think there's a misconception that the public investment in transit is causing a loss of choice, that we're going to try and take people's cars away, that we're going to force people into dense environments, when in fact the opposite is true. Let me see if this. When we make massive investments in infrastructure, in new road construction and widening, that in fact is coercing people into driving. Government is saying, if you want to participate in society, if you want to participate in community, if you want jobs in Oklahoma City, you will drive everywhere. You will buy a car, you will buy car insurance, you will buy a tag every year, and you will drive, because there is no choice. And that is the lack of freedom. Freedom involves choice. And unfortunately, when you spend the equivalent of 4 years' transit budget, or $50 million widening streets like this that don't have the vehicle per day counts to justify widening them, $3 million per street, and you don't build sidewalks for 40 years in a city, and you massively underfund transit, you are coercing people into driving. You are removing choice. The average cost of owning and maintaining a vehicle is about $10,000 a year. So what happens to the citizen? A minimum wage job is $15,000 a year. Somebody needs to explain that math. $15,000 a year and the average cost of a vehicle is $10,000. What happens to the family that has to buy a car for every adult in the family, and then a 16-year-old comes along, you have to buy another car? People are having to make choices, sometimes perhaps even between education, between sending somebody to college. This is eating up large amounts of income. Jarrett Walker is going to talk about transit planning concepts, which will help us. But in preparation, I want to provide some context about conditions and strategies which we are using, which are unique to Oklahoma City, and which we're an outlier. Now, being an outlier is not necessarily bad. Anytime you have a new idea, or a proponent of a new idea, you're going to be an outlier. But it's also true that in nature, it's the animal that wanders off from the herd that usually gets picked off by the predator. For city or state governments which have adopted a policy or plan which is unique among governments, they must know that they are an outlier, and they must be able to recite to you very quickly the reasons that they're an outlier. The MAPS program is an example. To collect sales tax for years and have it in the bank and then make large capital investments is very unique. It's done on a small scale. In some municipalities, it is never done in any city on this scale. So Oklahoma City is an outlier, and we're very comfortable with that. It helps us pass the measures. It's a fiscally conservative populace, which doesn't like debt, doesn't like passing interest, and it gives us time to make adjustments. So we're an outlier. We understand why, and we're okay with that. Oklahoma is the only state in America which precludes its cities from accessing income tax or property tax to finance its discretionary budget or its general fund. We're the only state in America that is completely dependent on sales tax to fund things like transit. So we're very susceptible to peaks and valleys. We're one recession away from having to make large cuts. We are still trying to replace the police officers, for example, that we were unable to fund during the last downturn in 2008 because we can only train so many each year. The impact of consumer and government decisions and behavior is amplified as well. If you purchase things online, you're supposed to pay a use tax, but nobody really does. So the lost revenue to the city of Oklahoma City from people purchasing things on the internet and not paying their use tax is about $15 to $17 million a year. To put that in perspective, our total transit budget is about $24 million. but most of that's state and federal and fares. So the amount that the Oklahoma City puts into its budget is $12 million. The amount that it would cost to bring Sunday bus service online is $1.5 million. And somehow we have not been able to find that $1.5 million. Another thing to keep in perspective is Doug's talking about regional things and this unique sales tax environment is that it pits the municipalities against each other. It creates an adversarial relationship. The outlet mall on I-40 and Council is wildly successful. It's been great in terms of sales tax. They came, you know, they said, we want to be on I-40 and Council, but more, you know, they want us to, and they're going to give us this. What can you give us? And they pit us back and forth. And unfortunately, some of these things create an adversarial relationship among the cities. We can overcome it. I just want to acknowledge that that is the situation that we've been placed in by this sales tax dependence. Here's something else to think about. The day after Sheriff Wetzel was elected in November, the next day we heard that he wanted a sales tax to be on the ballot in March, about a half a cent for 10 years. What that would mean for the city of Oklahoma City that's dependent on sales tax for its general fund or for anything, any initiative it wants to do, like MAPS or police officers or transit, is substantial. This would represent a significant paradigm shift. And yet, if you add a half a cent sales tax in Oklahoma County, you really have probably effectively buried regional transit. Everything that Doug was talking about is going to require a dedicated funding source. And yet, we didn't hear anything from anyone when that was announced. And it's now been delayed till the fall, and we'll see what happens. Hopefully by now everybody has heard of the concept that if you spend money on local businesses, more of that money stays in the local economy. It recirculates and then city government benefits. That behavior is amplified here where we're so dependent on sales tax. So similarly, the average amount that an individual or family would save by not having a car or not having to have a second or a third car is about $10,000 a year. Now, what happens if they then get to spend that $10,000 a year in the local economy? The one exception to the city getting sales tax is gasoline. So all the gasoline that most of us, the overwhelming majority of us, are buying each week, the city doesn't get any of that sales tax. It all goes to the state and federal government. So if some of that is diverted and people are participating in the economy and buying things, our government benefits and we're able to provide more services. If you are able to integrate the 6,000 blind, the 28,000 who are visually impaired to such a degree that they can't drive, the 1 out of 5 senior citizens who cannot drive because of public health, because of health reasons, if you integrate them into the economy and they're able to spend and participate, you are going to drive economic development. And when we think about transit investments, these are intangibles, they're difficult to quantify, but they need to be considered as a return on investment. If you look at where, this applies to mobility of the poor. If you look at where the poor are concentrated, they're heavily concentrated in 10 zip codes. It's about 17% of the Oklahoma City population, or 1 out of 6 people, 100,000 people live below the poverty line in the Oklahoma City area. How many jobs have you eliminated for that populace by not running transit in the evenings or on Sundays? How many retail jobs have you precluded them from obtaining? How much have you restricted food choice, getting to travel and shop around? Instead, we have food deserts, and we have this populace shopping in convenience stores, and that has public health implications. So if you overlay a map of where our public health epidemics are most pronounced, it's largely a mirror of the map of poverty in Oklahoma City. It's the same 10 zip codes. So the impact of poverty on poverty is only one way that public transportation is a public health issue. Obesity is growing faster than any public health epidemic in the history of the United States, and it's growing faster here than virtually anywhere in the country. And driving is contributing to the problem. Basically, public transportation is a public health issue because you avoid the risks of driving and you add a component of walking. The most high-risk activity that essentially all of us will engage in our lives is driving automobiles. It only takes one time to look away from the wheel and have an accident. How many bars do we have in Oklahoma City? And let's be honest with ourselves. If we're not having any transit service in the evenings, how many people are drinking and driving? How many people are smoking weed or whatever their drug of choice is? How many are on prescription medications? How many are looking at their smartphones? How many are listening to their kids fight behind them? That's the result. That causes 40,000 deaths. That is the leading cause of deaths of people less than 33 years old. That leads to 2 million injuries a year and $200 billion a year in healthcare costs. It is a rare day in my spinal medical practice that I do not see someone come through the door with whiplash injuries. It is substantial. Public transit, on the other hand, contributes to public health because it always has a walking component at the beginning and the end. And the better your transit system, the farther people will be willing to walk. And so that is the principal way that it impacts public health. We're all designed to walk 10,000 steps a day, but with ruthless efficiency, we have engineered walking out of our lives. Transit is a way that we bring walking back into our lives. I'm going to leave discussion to the trade-offs on bus service to Mr. Walker, but I want to focus on areas on our bus service in which we're an outlier. First, we are the only city with more than 500,000 people, other than Tulsa, which does not have a dedicated funding source. That to me is the principal budgetary problem. We are substantially underfunded compared to cities across the region and the nation, and we are one recession away from looking at cuts, and it makes it very difficult to plan. Second, the transit systems in large cities are generally run by regional transit authorities, not by the municipality, and absolutely no city in America is trying to provide transit service to 621 square miles. We began with routes that were relatively straight, and then we succumbed to this group of senior citizens, or this big box retail store, or this shopping mall, or towards the home of one or more faithful transit riders, or we bent the routes to accommodate a request from a city councilor, and so on, until we have routes that look like this. Now we have a transit system which, in trying to serve everybody, serves no one. By trying to cover so much geographic area, it has to run so infrequently that it has difficulty attracting ridership. Third, we have a unique arrangement with advertisers and the nature of our bus benches. The arrangement that we've had for many years is that private advertising firms are allowed to place bus benches consisting of concrete and 2x4s anywhere they want along our bus routes. With no discipline, we put them wherever we want, and so the bus has to stop wherever those benches are. And they keep 100% of the revenue. That is highly unusual. That is highly irregular. When we sell the advertising around the buses, we have 50-50 splits, 70-30 splits. To have a private advertising firm keep, 100% of the revenue, when they're charging as much as $300 a month, you're talking about millions of dollars of revenue, of which none is shared with our transit agency. It is $1.5 million to bring Sunday bus service online. And so that needs to be examined. But more importantly, well, just importantly, is the message that we send about our transit riders. When this is more an advertising, a billboard, than a functional component of a transit system. What is the message that we're sending when we have transit riders sit too close to fast-moving traffic, when we put them on display, when we fail to protect them from the Oklahoma City wind and rain and sun and snow, when we have them sit on uneven 2x4s, when we don't even give them the courtesy of posting schedules or maps or routes on the benches so that we can maximize advertising space. The message is, it's not just that we don't respect you, you have no value to us. You have no value in society. The message that's sent to us as we're driving in our car is, thank God I'm not in that situation. Thank God I'm not a transit rider and I have to use a bus. The basic requirements of attracting ridership to a transit system are high frequency, being on time, having the schedule and routes be easy to understand, having dignified transit stops, pushing the information to everybody's smartphone so that we know it's 3 minutes away, 2 minutes away, 1 minute away. Now that brings us to the streetcar. As Doug pointed out, we had a regional transit dialogue. We talked about different options, bus rapid transit, and different options, one of which was the streetcar. The streetcar was not the top choice. It was down a few pegs. But that's what we ended up voting on. We had a website in which people were able to contribute. What did they want on the Map Street ballot? And many people put transit. You could then enter lower down comments. You could put streetcar. You could vote as many times as you wanted from the same computer. And we saw an influx of a large number of votes for the streetcar. The question that I think needs to be examined is, after we engaged in a fixed guideway study and knowing that there were many alternatives to improving our transit system, how did we arrive at a decision to invest all $120 million in the streetcar? There was no study that advocated for that. There was no consultant who said, if you want to improve your transit system, you should take all $120 million, walk up to the roulette wheel, and put it all on this number. There was no one suggested that. Nobody advocated for that. The strategy that's verbalized by many advocates goes something like this. The bus system is hopelessly dysfunctional. It's seen as existing solely to move the poor and disabled around, and we will never get buy-in from young professionals and the upper middle and upper classes whose support we would need to get a vote passed for a dedicated funding source such as a sales tax for a regional transit authority. And so we will invest in a streetcar, and people will fall in love with rail, they'll fall in love with the technology, and then a rising tide lifts all transit ships, and 10 years from now, after we have a dedicated funding source and a regional transit authority, 10 years from now, then we'll get improvements to our bus system. That is the strategy. So how are we an outlier in this strategy? The first is that we were the first city to attempt to build a streetcar without having a robust transit system in place. There's some 20 cities who have either built a streetcar or in the process of designing or building a streetcar. All of them have robust bus systems. All of them have robust transit systems except for Oklahoma City. Second, we are the only city not to receive federal funds. We applied for it. It looks like Kansas City will get it. That means the federal government will participate in streetcar projects in 19 cities, refusing to participate with only one, and that is Oklahoma City. Part of the calculus in our strategy involved the idea that we could obtain matching federal funds to further our investment. And that's a reasonable assumption. They love to invest it. They've invested in 19 cities. They've spent hundreds of millions of dollars. But it shouldn't have been a surprise. I love this scene with Jim Carrey. And he said, and the woman says, I'm not going to date you. And he says, like, one in 100, I'm not going to date you. And she says, no, like, one in 1,000,000, I'm not going to date you. And he says, so you're telling me I've got a chance, right? We knew this. The lining was on the wall. We talked to the federal government, and they told us, you don't have a plan for paying the operations and maintenance. If you don't have a plan for paying for the operations and maintenance of your streetcar, you don't have a project, and you're not going to get federal funding. We don't want to see you take on a new mode that adds more than 5% of your current transit budget for new operations and maintenance. So 20, 25 million, I mean, they don't want to see you add more than 1 million. The cost to run a streetcar would be some $3 to $4 million a year. We were never going to get federal government. We never had a chance. But somehow we all thought we did. I mean, that was part of the deal. That was part of the pack. That's why we opted for this. We were going to spend $120 million and we'll get $60 million in matching funds. We never got to first base. We are an outlier in terms of that of the payment. We don't have a plan 3 years after the vote to pay for the operations and maintenance of a streetcar. Every streetcar project in the United States, except for Oklahoma City, has a diverse funding source. They're getting funds from multiple sources to pay for their operations and maintenance. They're getting a combination of federal funding, a dedicated tax, a special assessment district or a business improvement district, so on. Because the real estate values along these rail lines tend to greatly increase in value, the property owners in these cities have been willing to form partnerships with their respective cities in which they pay a special assessment. In fact, in Portland, the one that everybody looks to, which actually the people never voted on, it was the developers who came with the idea to do a streetcar. The developers are always in place first. You always have that partnership first in all of these cities except for Oklahoma City. One consultant told me, you in Oklahoma City are like the teenager mowing the lawn. You're mowing the lawn, then you're knocking on the door and asking to be paid. You need to knock on the door first and find out who is willing to be a partner with you. So we've spent years drawing routes about where a streetcar might go without talking to anyone along these routes whose property values are likely to substantially increase about whether they'd be willing to partner with us. You don't draw the route until you talk to potential partners along different streets. So what feedback we have got is that we're not going to have partners, and that's okay, but we just need to recognize that we're doing it differently than the 19 other cities in America who are doing that. We don't have a strategy. This lack of a strategy for paying for the operations and maintenance is not just a function of the streetcar. And that's what, so pressure will come not just from paying the streetcar. It's that we don't have a plan currently for paying the operations and maintenance for the park or the senior wellness centers or other projects. In fact, it could be $10 to $15 million of new operations and maintenance to our general fund for which we currently today have no plan how to pay for. So returning to the strategy of using the streetcar as a rising tide which will lift all transit ships, it would appear to be a high-risk strategy. We're engaged in a strategy which is radically different than all other cities, and if we fail, we will likely never obtain the buy-in from the taxpayer and the public for the passage of a dedicated funding source, a regional transit authority, and our bus system may deteriorate even further. All things equal, I love trains. I love rail. Would I prefer to get on a streetcar as opposed to a bus? Yeah, I would. It's quieter. It's for a lot of reasons. It's cool. But is it as cool if I know that when I'm getting on the streetcar, that is going to cause somebody else to have to sit out in the rain, a mother and her kids sit out in the rain while the cars drive by and splash them with water? It's not as cool if I know that senior citizens have to sit at home because they don't have frequent or bus service so that I can get on something downtown that's going to take me a short distance that I could probably walk. Now, here's where our current strategy is going to hit a brick wall, and that is Title VI. And we are unfortunately going to learn some of this lesson with the boulevard, in that the public made some requests, wanted things studied, wanted things looked at. We didn't understand the federal NEPA process. And now there's going to be a period of pain as we delay until the year 2016 while we're Well, we have some legal entanglements. This current situation is a textbook case of what Title VI was created to prevent. You cannot treat one segment of the populace, of one ethnicity or one socioeconomic class in one way, and then treat other socioeconomic classes and other ethnicities a completely different way. That is exactly what happened in Atlanta, and that's exactly what happened in Los Angeles. And for 10 years, Los Angeles got to do their transit planning in the courts. This is more of a dramatic difference than what happened in those two cities. So if all you do is engage in the current plan, you're going to hit a brick wall with Title VI. Now, what's happened in some cities like Portland currently is that as they're coming under budgetary constraints and they're having difficulty paying for their streetcar budget, they're eating deeper and deeper into their bus budget. So if you start to see cannibalization of our bus budget, our underfunded, underutilized, if you start to eat into that even further because you're trying to find ways to pay for $3 to $4 million of a new mode of transit, you're going to decimate the bus system. It will be a slam dunk. There's no way that will get past a Title VI challenge in court. The problem is that streetcars have been decisive in cities. They have created this class tensions. They have created by its very nature, it says you don't want to be on the bus, you want to be on a streetcar. And we're going to treat this class different than that class. We don't want to go there as a city. We do not want that kind of class tension. We do not want the kind of social instability that results from that kind of strategy. I have an idea of what I'd like to see. I'd like to see diversification of transit investments. I'd like to see all in technology, push this to our smartphones, perhaps a smaller streetcar route that goes to important destinations on both ends of the route, like downtown to the Health Science Center. Perhaps a contracted bus system with a higher frequency, but ultimately I don't want you to put too much stock in what any one individual has to say, including myself. There's another way. I would hope that everybody would listen to the concepts laid out by Mr. Walker, process them, and then we all work together over the ensuing months where there would be lots more public meetings. After we have the studies that Nelson Nygaard is doing on the bus and which Jacobs is doing on the streetcar route, there will be lots of opportunities for all of us to engage. What's more important than a particular transit strategy is to overhaul the process that we utilize as a city in executing projects. It's not about somebody's right or somebody's wrong. Is this process effective? Is it working for us, and could we do it better? MAPS 3 is critical. The whole MAPS institution is critical to the city. It's been wildly successful. It creates a lot of, it's basically, I think, like a full-blown WPA program that creates a lot of construction jobs. It is having a tremendous impact on our economy and economic development, and it must be protected and maintained. The process, though, needs overhauling. The process needs more than tweaking. Never again should we take such risk with our city's future without thoroughly vetting these projects and having a plan as to how we're going to pay for a project, much less four of them. As difficulties arise in implementing some of these projects, what I think is happening is there's a fear among policymakers that we can't change the projects because that there'll be resentment among the public. We promised them this, and so we've got to stick to the plan. They won't forgive us. And then the MAPS institution will die, and there'll be and so we've got to push forward, even though we're starting to find adversity. I think the larger threat to the MAPS program is that we follow through with a project which fails. That, to me, is the greatest threat to MAPS. The more fiscally conservative taxpayer-responsive strategy is to report back to the public and make adjustments if necessary after seeking input from the public. We find out things over 3 years and we report it back to you. We thought we could do it this way, but it didn't work out. We have new information now. Title VI wasn't on anybody's radar. Here's the new information. We reported back to you. What I would ask for you is leniency and to let us maneuver and adjust. That's more responsible. The bottom line is that diversity of thought leads to better decision making. James Surowiecki, in his book Wisdom of Crowd, talked about an experiment. If you have a big jar of jelly beans, and you ask people to guess how many, one person will be closest. But there's a way to get much closer to the reality, and that's to ask 1,000 people. Studies show that large groups of people, when part of the decision-making, get much closer to the reality. Larger, more diverse crowds have been shown over and over to make accurate decisions. We're going to keep having these town halls. We're going to keep inviting nationally recognized speakers, and I'm going to keep reporting back to you what we're facing in a way that is completely honest at all times. All I ask is that you engage us and give us your feedback and input, and that you keep coming back. This process works if we work at it. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Shadid. A lot of food for thought. And our next speaker is going to give us additional food for thought. Several of us, or a number of us, had the opportunity to spend the day with Jarrett Walker yesterday and really gained a lot of insight into public transit. Jarrett Walker is an international consultant in public transit planning and policy, including the links between transit and all aspects of community planning and urban structure. His clients include transit authorities, cities, developers, and nonprofits. Anyone who wants to make better use of public transit as a tool to support resilient communities, individual liberty, and social inclusion. In his 20 years of consulting experience, he worked on more than 200 projects across North America, Australia, and New Zealand, spanning the range from small towns to major metro areas. Jarrett Walker has built a strong track record in a range of transit planning and policy issues, including bus rail integration, bus rapid transit, flexible services planning, and innovative public consultation. He has written and worked extensively on the integration of public transit into community planning at all scales, from the design of a small development to the structure of an urban region. His work covers the entire spectrum of planning perspectives, from visionary urbanism to operational detail. Jarrett Walker is also known for his work on educating stakeholders about the choices that transit requires, building a clear consultation process, and helping organizations form coherent and achievable transit goals. Since 2009, he has written the popular blog, humantransit.org, which has grown into an online collection of articles explaining key transit concepts and issues. In November 2011, Island Press released his book, Human Transit, How Clear Thinking About Public Transit Can Enrich Our Communities and Our Lives. Please join me in welcoming Jarrett Walker.
I want to start by saying something a little bit unscripted that I've been thinking this evening. Ever since my book Human Transit came out a couple of years ago, I've been invited to many cities all over America to help communities think about public transit. And almost always when I go to one of these cities, there's a town hall event like this. And they do lots of networking, and they put the word out, and they really try to bring lots of people out who care about public transit. And I've done these kinds of talks in places like Seattle and San Francisco and Washington, D.C. and Boston. And you know what? You are the largest audience that has come out in that entire time. Yes, give yourselves a hand. And I'm sorry to say that a couple days ago, I was on the phone with my publisher in Washington, D.C., and I told her I was going to Oklahoma, and she said, Oklahoma? And I said, yes, and do you think folks would buy some books down? I don't know. I mean, who's going to want to talk about transit in Oklahoma? I don't know. I mean, so as a result, I have only 7 books here. And if you all buy those, I'm going to have to send the rest of you to Amazon. But you showed us, didn't you? I wasn't expecting this. I wasn't expecting it. Okay. The most important sentence in my book, and the most important idea that's really been driving my work, especially for the last 2 years since I, or the last 3 years since I started working on the book, is really this sentence. My job is not to make you share my values, but to help give you the tools to clarify and advocate yours. And that's important, because I'm from a green, hippie, granola-eating, weird, rainy, confusing, moldy place called Portland, Oregon. And why should you want my values here in Oklahoma? Well, maybe you do want some of them, or maybe you don't, but it's your choice. And I believe very strongly in talking about choice, talking about freedom, talking about personal responsibility. I want those to be bipartisan words that we all know how to use. So, my role is to ask you some questions. There are going to be some times tonight where it's going to sound like I'm advocating. I'm going to start sounding a little like Councilman Shadid with a sense of what we really should be doing here. But when I'm doing that, I want you to notice. I want you to listen carefully, and I want you to remember in the back of your mind what I'm telling you now, which is if I seem to advocate something, it's only because you've already heard the opposite. You don't need to hear that from me. I'm here to just open up another possibility in your minds. You still have a choice. And if you all say you want this over here, then I'm here to help you do that. That's my job. There are lots of other consultants who will come to town and tell you what you should do and what you should want. And I'm here to help you get what you want. So some of the questions I'm going to be asking tonight are about how you want to think about transit technology, how you want to think about those, you know, all those pictures that Mr. Rex showed of all those exciting things, and darn, isn't it sad that we can't have a monorail? They're so shiny and fast-looking. Well, I'm going to ask you some questions about technology. I'm going to ask you about I'm going to present a concept called abundant access, and it's going to look like I'm an advocate of that. But there's an alternative to that, and I'm going to invite you to find your own place in that. And then I'm going to ask you about something called transit-oriented development that you may have heard of, and the question of what's a transit-friendly location, because this is where freedom connects with personal responsibility. So, when I'm at a party, and people don't know who I am, and they introduce themselves to me, and they ask me what I do, and I say, well, I'm a consultant, I work on improving public transit systems, and always, their next question is, what do I think about some technology? That is the standard cocktail party response to the topic of public transit. Oh, yeah, what do you think about monorails or streetcars or, you know, this new levitation thingy or, you know, these horizontal ski lifts that they're thinking about in Austin or whatever it is. What do you think about that? And I say, well, that depends on what you're trying to do. It depends on what problem you're trying to solve. And so the starting question is, are we sure that technology is the goal, which is what the media will tend to assume, and what so many people will tend to assume, or maybe the technology is a tool, and the goal is something else. I worked for 5 years, and I lived and worked for 5 years in Australia, which is an amazing country to live in because it feels like Oklahoma a lot of the time, except they have pretty good public transit and a lot of other interesting differences in values, even though they're all cowboys inside, just like you. And or just like you pretend to be, or just like you're presented on TV. And I spend a lot of time in a city called Melbourne. And Melbourne is famous, along with Toronto, for being the two developed world cities that never tore out their old streetcar systems, or trams, as they call them down there. And the streetcars, by the way, are big and crowded and busy and going right down the middle of things. They are major lines that run all the way across the city. But when I get on one of them, the streetcar company that runs them, when I get on one of them and look at the wall of the streetcar, I see this map. And setting aside the graphic design wisdom of yellow lines on a white background, the larger question I have this map is that this map shows me where all the trams go. Because, after all, since I'm on a tram, I must be a tram person. I must be interested in trams, right? Well, there's another possible explanation, which is that I'm on this tram because this is the thing that goes where I'm going. I may actually just want to get where I'm going. And so when you show me that, see all those lines going way up in the north and not touching each other, right? What if I want to go east-west up there? This map assumes that I'm a tram person, which means I'll be happy to ride all the way down into downtown Melbourne and all the way back up, because after all, I'm a tram person. When in fact, there are lots of east-west buses running back and forth across there, and I might want to know about those, because maybe I want to know about my public transit system, because I want to go where I want to go, rather than just knowing about one technology. It's possible. So this is question, is technology a goal or is technology a tool? And the goal is something else. And when I'm going to introduce the term abundant access, which is really the title of my next book, to capture maybe a term you might want to think about as maybe the thing you're trying to do, but again, it's your choice. But already, I can say that much, and a lot of people out there are saying, but come on, you're about to talk about buses, aren't you? You're reading us into talking about buses. You're going to try to sell us buses. But, you know, buses are for poor people. And I think Councilman Shadid has already done this part of my presentation, which is that if your infrastructure looks like it looks here, then yes, you are advertising to everyone who drives past that that's what buses are for. And you're encouraging every motorist to view people who use the bus system with, at best, pity rather than respect. And that's a long way from being able to start breaking down the barriers to where people can start considering the possibility that the bus system might be useful to them. I'm going to say one thing quickly thing in passing here, and you can find more of it. If you're interested in this whole question of stigma around buses and how to talk about it to melt it down, Google my name along with the words bus stigma, and you'll find an article I did for The Atlantic that spends a lot more time taking that idea apart. But transit succeeds by breaking out of class categories, by not playing that game, and that means by becoming attractive to a wide range of people, although maybe not the elite. And so there's a bit of work here. Many years ago when I was presenting a transit, like the folks in Nelson and I are here tonight, I had developed a bit of a transit plan for a suburban area in Southern California, and I was presenting that to the board of the transit agency. And one of the board members leaned forward and said, "Now, Mr. Walker, if we adopt this plan of yours, will that make me leave my BMW in the driveway?" And I hope I said something polite, but the answer is obviously no, we're not trying to do that. You know what? If you have a BMW, and if you are so attached to your BMW that you needed us all to know that right now, then you're going to drive your BMW. And you know what? That's fine, because there aren't very many of you. Congratulations, Councilman. But by the very fact of being on a city council, you are part of an elite. Congratulations. But there aren't very many of you, really, in the scheme of things. And I come back to this over and over, and one of the challenges that highly successful elite people in your society need to face is that they are not the design customer. And their tastes, the kind of transit system that might make them leave their BMW in the driveway, is not necessarily what we need to aim for. What we need to aim for is something that a vast, diverse group of people, maybe not including the elite, will find useful. right? Because if you've written a successful transit system, a system that is driving its city's economy, if you have ridden the London Underground or the New York City subway or even the buses in Portland, Oregon, what we have left, you'll have noticed that there's a huge diversity of people on them. And I don't just mean ethnic diversity, I mean diversity of ages, diversity of trip purposes, people doing all kinds of different things. And that's what great transit systems do. One product that appeals to this huge diversity of people. Now, when you focus, so what if you focus not on the vehicle but on what it does? What if before you choose the vehicle, you think about what you want to do in the way of transportation? Or do you want to do commuter express? Do you want to do frequent local service within the city? Do you want to do rapid transit, which generally means frequent service, widely spaced stops for going long distances at high density? Do you want circulators? Well, these are all things that either a bus or a rail vehicle can do and do. The right tool will be different in different places. Like Councilman Shadid, I love rail too, and there are places where rail is right. Does this look like attractive transit to you? Does this look like civilized transit to you? It takes a moment to notice, doesn't it, that that's a bus. You have to notice the wheel wells, which the design has actually partly concealed here. This is a bus. It looks like this. It looks like this. Is this a nice station? Is that a civilized facility? It's a bus, but it's in its own lane. And because it's in its own lane, it can run reliably. If you value actual reliable operations, being in your own lane or track, but fundamentally not having stuff get in your way, is more important than whether you're on rails or tires. It matters more. See, I told you, he's a bus advocate. He's bringing this up. He keeps saying he's not, but he keeps bringing it back. No, but abundant access, broadly useful transit that lots of people find useful, arises from some specific things. Five things to remember: speed, frequency, span, reliability, and capacity. So what's transit trying, and I'll come back to those in a minute, what's transit trying to do? What is this abundant access thing I'm talking about? Well, here's a map of it. Here's a map of Portland, Oregon. And this is from a little device that walkscore.com developed but didn't really promote because they weren't sure quite what to do with it. But I think it's one of the most important online tools I've ever seen, and I'm working right now on getting it popularized and available. This is a little tool where you can plunk your pointer down on a place of interest, and these blobs, the technical word for them is isochrones, these blobs show you how far you can get on transit plus walking in 15, 30, 45 minutes. Now, we're all used to thinking about this the other way around. How long will it take me to get where I'm going? Travel time. I want you to turn the idea of travel time inside out and visualize this as a freedom. Not how long will it take me to get to work, but where could I get to in 30 minutes? Visualize that this is a map of your freedom as we experience freedom in transportation, which is how much of the riches of my city are readily available to me if I choose to be a transit rider or I'm a transit rider for any reason. It's a map of your freedom. And when I talk about abundant access, I'm talking about the size of these blobs and the size of these blobs for the most people in the city. And an abundant access agenda would be an agenda that's about making these blobs bigger, and in particular, expanding them so they include more things that people value. One of the cool things about this tool is that you can make a completely selfish judgment about your own access. You can look at that and decide whether you can get to the places that matter to you. But more generally, you can aggregate this and think about, how effectively can people get to everything that's of value in their city. Now, one of the other cool things this does is it helps you take responsibility for your location decisions. Because if you're going to set up an office maybe that people are going to need to get to on transit, it matters if you locate it downtown or maybe, out in the east side grid a bit, or you might choose to locate it in some leafy suburb. And that has huge consequences for your access, as it should. And we'll come back to location choice. So again, what's abundant access made of? I gave you this list before, five variables: frequency, span, speed, reliability, and capacity. Span means duration, how long it runs, whether it runs on Sunday. Does technology matter? I mean, monorails look so fast, right? Isn't that how we get speed, by buying something fast? No, actually. Here's how technology matters in delivering these abundant access outcomes. If you want to be able to run extreme frequency, if you want to be able to run every 3 minutes at 2 a.m, and you have a huge volume of people, then you want driverless rapid transit like Vancouver has. And you need some technology to get to driverlessness. You're not there. But there's a lot of interesting things happening on driverless transportation, as you know, and that may change. If you need capacity, if you need to move a huge number of people with one driver, then you need a train. But speed and reliability are just not about whether you're on rails or tires. They are about how long you stop and what can get in your way. They are about the way that you handle passenger stops, and they are about the nature of the lane in front of you and what can obstruct it, and what your options are when it's obstructed. So abundant access means expanding these blobs. Seems like a great thing, because we're talking literally about expanding freedom, because this is what we mean by freedom in transportation. It's not about transportation at all. It's about access to your city. It's about the sense that you can live in Oklahoma City and have access to Oklahoma City instead of being in any sense trapped. The opposite of this is a sensation of being trapped, not being able to move. I want to point out, now I want to talk a little bit provocatively about something called symbolic transit. Symbolic transit, which is a thing that conflicts often with abundant access, arises from the idea that we need to represent abundant access so that people will recognize it, and that sometimes we actually sacrifice some abundant access in order to create something that looks like it or that makes people emotionally respond in a particular way. And a very simple mathematical example is what happens when you separate the two directions of a transit line and start moving them apart from each other. I have heard several times, and I've read several times, among people who believe that the role of a rail project is to generate development, and who believe that the relationship is in some sense that we put rails in the street and buildings sprout in response. And by the way, that's not what happened in Portland. You go to Portland now and it looks like that would happen, but what happened in Portland was that the same people designed the streetcar and the development at the same time, and they were all at the same table, and as the councilor mentioned, there was also a lot more financial involvement. But you can't look at Portland's experience and say that that proves a cause and effect relationship between the rails and the development, because it all happened at once by the same people. But I want to make a different, simpler point, which applies to any kind of transit, including buses, which is now and then you will hear that if we move the two directions apart and put them on different streets, that will generate more goodness, because it will generate goodness on two streets instead of one. And so the further apart we move the two directions of travel, the more goodness we're generating. That kind of goodness is symbolic transit, because when you expand the symbol of service, which in this case is the rail in the street, until the streetcar comes, the rail in the street is a symbol, right? You can't ride it until the streetcar comes. So if you move it further apart, you've spread it over more area, but if you want actually to use the service, you have reduced the area that finds the service useful. And that's for one brutally obvious reason, which is that if you want transit to be useful, you need to be able to get there and get back, which means you need to be able to access both directions of the service, right? And the further the two directions of service get apart, that's what the blue area here is signaling. The further you separate the two directions of service, the smaller the area that can comfortably walk to both directions. So this is a beautiful example where the symbolism and the actuality are pointing us in opposite directions. And it's an example of a choice that you'll have to think about. And I'm not talking just about the streetcar, because this will come up in a lot of other contexts too. Abundant access is a freedom. But freedom, as we know, means responsibility. In this country, we value our freedom of choice, but we also believe in taking responsibility for the consequences of our choices. At least that's the ideal. Transit mobility is the result of your location. No matter how good your transit system is, it is going to be better or worse depending on where you are. As a result, one of the most urgent things that every city needs to do is think about where things are locating and send the right signals about where to locate. That's one of the reasons I love that tool, by the way, and I'm trying to popularize it, because that helps people make good decisions themselves or at least own the consequences of whatever decision they make. We have a lot of experience in California with making budget cuts to, where I worked for many years, making budget cuts to human services agencies. And human services agencies feel they're on the ropes, and when they open a new facility, they're under great pressure to open it as cheaply as possible, which means to find the cheapest possible land, and the cheapest possible land is hard to get to. That's how land becomes cheap, right? And so they locate back in some industrial park on some secondary or tertiary street, and then they suddenly get upset because the bus doesn't go there. And they call up the transit agency and say, "Where are you?" It's not just social service agencies that make this mistake. We used to have a lot of fun joking about the fact that it always seemed in the San Francisco area, there are laws that say that, you know, a developer, whenever he builds anything of size, needs to make a certain infrastructure contribution to public transit. And so the result of this well-intentioned law was that every development that got built, wherever it was, had a bus shelter in front of it, provided by the developer, only on his side of the street, of course. And it was though they all believed, you know, if I build a bus shelter, that means a bus will come, right? That's how it works in SimCity. You just build things and they suddenly operate. Isn't that how it works? No, it's not. And in particular, building a bus shelter in front of your facility will not necessarily get your transit agency to do what it has to do to get to it. In this case, the transit agency was successfully bullied into doing it, but look at the sacrifice they made. The bus has to go around in a circle just in order to get to that one place. And as a result of that, everybody else who wants to get everywhere has to ride around in a circle with it. And that's having an effect on people's sense about whether this is a reasonable way to get around. So this issue about locating something that people will need to get to in a way that makes it, and locating it cheaply by locating it in a place where it's hard to get to is bad news. And this also goes to our personal location choices, and it's a very, very important issue, not just for senior citizens, but for future senior citizens, which include absolutely everyone in this room. The decision you make about where to live as a senior citizen is one of the clearest cases where you've got absolute freedom of choice and you're going to bear real consequences from whatever you choose, and you have to own those consequences. And if you end up living in a place where transit can't get to you, and you can yell at the transit agency forever, and you may or may not succeed in getting them to run some incredibly inefficient service to thread the labyrinth back to wherever you are, but that's not how you're going to ever feel very secure about your transit service. You're going to feel secure about your transit service if you've located in a place where transit can succeed. And so I want to talk a little bit about that and about the slogan, "Be on the Way," because this is my own definition of transit-oriented development. And there are a lot of prestigious urbanists and architects out there promoting something called transit-oriented development who haven't quite wrapped their heads around this. And so it's an important thing to keep coming back to. Transit-oriented development, or development that's intended to work with public transit has to be located not just on public transit, but on public transit that can succeed. And so you have to go back to the idea of what makes public transit successful. What makes a transit line incredibly useful to an incredible number of people so that there are lots of people on it? And the answer is, what you want is a line that feels reasonably straight. It doesn't have to be literally straight. It just has to be a reasonably direct path, not circuitous, in other words, not bending back on itself, but reasonably direct, with lots of different destinations on it that people want to go to and travel among. Not just dense housing, but, you know, a downtown, a university, a hospital. Get those things in a line. And if you haven't built them yet, build them such that they will be in a line. That's how you build a successful transit line, because people want to go back and forth in great numbers all day and all evening. And the line feels reasonably straight between any two points on the line, even if you're passing through other points on the way. That's why it's important not to slow down too much just because you're going through an acute district on the way. You have to be time competitive. The opposite of that is the cul-de-sac, but not just the little residential cul-de-sac that you're thinking about, but any time that you set yourself back from the obvious direct path. It can even just be Walmart setting itself a quarter mile back from the street that it's on, right? Or it can be any kind of prestigious facility that feels like the grand place to locate is that there should be a driveway from the street out there that goes around and up a little hill, and finally, we're way back here, right? What you're saying when you locate like that is that you want only as much transit service as you can justify all by yourself, right? If you want transit to go into whatever that cul-de-sac thing is, it thread that labyrinth that you live in, to get back to you, you're saying you want only as much transit as you're going to justify by yourself. And that's probably not going to be very much. I'll tell you a funny story about this. That's also in my book. Many years ago when I was doing a transit plan for a city for a small town, a small city really in California, in the Gold Country, about 50,000 people or so, and I was out riding the buses as you do. And we were riding the bus down this main street, and it all looked fine, and suddenly we turned onto a back street. And we drove down this back street, and it felt like we were going out of town. And suddenly the sidewalks disappeared, and we had mailboxes like every quarter mile, and we were out in the forest. And finally, we went down this long road and twisted back and forth, and finally down at the bottom of the road, there was a cattle garden, some cattle grazing on the other side. Basic rule of transit planning, if you can see cattle from the bus, you have gone too far. And we got back there, and the bus had to actually back up and make a Y turn to get itself turned around, go all the way back up to the street, go all the way back to the main street, and that turn kept going the way it was going. And I looked at the map, and that's the bus route. It does that every hour. That's actually what it's supposed to do. And so next time I'm talking to the transit manager in this town, I say, you know, this thing over here, what's that about? I mean, then that's, oh, that's Judy. She kept calling and writing letters, and finally kept calling the council and writing letters, and finally, you know, it wasn't going to stop until we sent the bus down there. Do you know if Judy still lives there? Mm-hmm. This happens inside transit agencies. And if you think your transit agency is unresponsive, sometimes they're too responsive. Everybody in town is riding down Judy's road and back and turning around in front of her cattle guard, thanks to the letter she wrote. That's not abundant access. Transit's going to have to go straight, and if you want great transit to whatever you're doing, whatever you're locating, you need to be in a place where transit can run straight. That is the brilliance of your one-mile grid. You can already see and the great diagonals that go out of the city like Classic. You can already see where those logical patterns are. Locate something between the state capitol and the medical center and you will have good transit. That transit is permanent, not because there are rails in the street, but because there's a permanent market. There are always going to be people wanting to go back and forth there. That's how you create permanence. And that's how you start driving real transit-oriented development. Finally, I want to make a really unlikely comment about a place that you're probably very familiar with, which is the post-war car-oriented commercial boulevard. You've probably seen places like this. Anyone know what city this is? Anyone call it out? Vegas. Okay, somebody finally recognized the Stratosphere Tower on the left. That is the only clue. Otherwise, you have no idea where this is, do you? This is America, right? What's wrong with this street? Well, it's pretty horrible for pedestrians. One thing is that as you're going down the street, you can't see a signal in the distance. Who knows how far it is to the next safe place to cross the street, right? I also love this photograph in particular because of the way the school zone sign is kind of ridiculing the design of the street. This street is designed to drive 60 miles an hour, and then you're suddenly supposed to drive 25 miles an hour between 3 and 5 p.m. The rest of the time, of course, you can go ahead and drive 60, and you know the kids fend for themselves if they're out. If they're out when they shouldn't be out, you know, right after school, they're only supposed to be out right after school. Other than that, you know, is this what you want? Is this what your values are? Here's the thing. The post-war commercial boulevard, deep down under its superficial awfulness, is actually great geography for transit because it's a lot of big destinations in a straight line. And that's what transit thrives on. So the fact that it's a horrible place for pedestrians is actually fairly superficial compared to the deeper, more unchangeable fact that there's a really good transit geography there if you just fixed this problem on the surface. And what I contend, and this is my idea and something that I've just been starting to promote, I introduced it in the book, and it doesn't get a lot of traction among the high-end urban designers, mostly because they're just interested in building higher-end places that appeal to people with more money. But what I'm talking about here is a simple intervention that makes places basically civilized and safe. And that is all that a lot of people need to get on transit, is to feel that the environment is safe, it's civilized, and again, that they are not pitied but respected. And the idea is very simple. Look at the logic of public transit when you locate crossing points on a street. And I want to propose a simple slogan that people could get behind, which is on all of these big commercial boulevards that are too fast for you to cross without a signal, you should have a safe street crossing and a transit stop every quarter mile. Why every quarter mile? Well, transit actually runs more efficiently, faster, and therefore more usefully if it doesn't stop too often. And this is another struggle, because Judy lives in between those stops, and when we pull out her stop, she will do exactly what she did when she lived at the end of that rural cul-de-sac. She will scream and write to all the councilmen, and there'll have to be a conversation about that. But in the bigger scheme of things, if we can stop a little less often, and you can build good pedestrian infrastructure. This ties totally into the other part of MAPS, which is about pedestrian infrastructure, right? So that it's civilized to walk to a stop every quarter mile. The bus will then run so much faster that it's worth it. People will walk further to better and more useful service. Though, when you first propose it, they will complain. So you have to be ready for that. You have to be ready to have that conversation and manage that change. But here's the thing, on the big commercial boulevard, when you put a stop on one side of this street where it is not safe to cross the street, what exactly are you doing? It's the same point we made before when we were looking at the one-way couplet. You don't have transit unless you can use it in both directions. If you can't cross the street safely between two stops, those stops are almost symbolic transit, aren't they? They don't really work. But of course, street crossings are expensive. So there's a convergence here of two needs, which is for transit to run more efficiently, for transit stops to be real and not symbolic, and to be able to make safe street crossings few enough that you can afford them, you can start doing them. And so those two values converge on the same idea, which is a safe street crossing every quarter mile and a bus stop every quarter mile. And as you visualize your one-mile grid, you should start to realize there's a kind of music to this, and that the land use should respond to that music, as it gradually would as planners think about this. Visualize driving down some big one-mile grid boulevard that's mostly suburban-style development, you know, lots and lots of little drive-in things with lots and lots of little driveways going out on the street. The traffic engineers, by the way, don't like that either. They always want to close those. They would always like to have fewer of those. Well, they can win, too. Because over time, what happens as you redevelop is you put denser things closer to the stops. You put the biggest things, like the shopping centers, at the one-mile grid intersections, which is where they already want to be, if you notice. And then every quarter mile, at the quarter-mile intersections, you have an opportunity for some apartments or for something else. And gradually, as things redevelop, things that matter get closer to those quarter-mile stops. And you have spaces in between where you put things that don't rely on transit as much. And overall, you start to build that natural rhythm. And if you drive your commercial boulevards today, you'll start noticing ways that the market actually wants that rhythm anyway. And just as the traffic engineers don't really like having just these endless driveways everywhere, just as you don't like them as a pedestrian, I'd like to be able to organize that. But the beauty of this is that this isn't some big new urbanist brick pavers and planter boxes and socialism kind of thing that's coming at you from some blue state. It's simply safety. It's safety, really. It's safety. And it starts with safety. And then it turns out that the safety that once you value pedestrian safety and the safety of bus riders who get off the bus, whoa, this actually converges with what's going to make a better transit system, quarter-mile spacing, moving the stops further apart, and then making it real safe to cross the street there. And you get this rhythm, this beat, right? The one-mile arterial is the downbeat, and then you got three beats, and then the one-mile arterial is the downbeat again. There's a music to it. But whether or not you need that metaphor, it's safety and it's more effective transit. And that's all it needs to be. You can still have a suburban sprawl boulevard with, and there's room for everything that's out there, all the car repair shops and all the little drive-in churches and everything else. There's room for all that, but with a safe place to cross the street every quarter mile. Think about it. So, in the end, though, although I've appeared to make proposals, every proposal I've made is simply a thing to think about, a choice for you, a thing for you to decide as a community about what kind of transit system is going to express your values. And so as I wrap up with these questions, that's what you need to remember. It's all about your choices, about what you decide as a community. Don't let anyone come in here from somewhere else and tell you what you should want. You need to figure out for yourselves what you want and how you're going to make these kinds of choices that naturally arise as we start building public transit together. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Mr. Walker. And thank you for coming out and showing your interest in the public transit dialogue tonight. Nelson Nygaard is going to be at the back with people ready to answer a couple of questions. Mr. Walker is going to be here for a little while. If nothing else, I think it's important for us to take away from here the message that our public transit system is important for the future of our community. And as Doug Rex said earlier, and I think he was quoting Roy Williams, we don't need to be looking at the city that we are. We need to be looking at the city that we want to be. And in order to grow up and realize the future that we can be, we need to be investing in public transit now. And so it's important for all of us to be talking about this and to be spreading the message and to tell our elected officials that this is important to us, and it's important to us today, and we're ready and willing to invest, because all of the things that we talked about tonight won't come to fruition if we aren't willing to invest in the system today. So I'm going to leave you with that, and thank you very much. We're going to continue to keep you informed. I know that Dr. Shadid has an interest in holding more of these public meetings. And so, again, thank you tonight for taking interest in public transit.